And another one I always tell people is if you do find yourself waking up or you're really having a difficult time falling asleep, do not stay in bed and toss and turn and clock watch, because that's only going to make the situation worse. You know, you're going to be tossing and turning. You're going to feel really uncomfortable. You're going to look at the clock. That's going to make you stress out about not getting enough sleep.
Joining me and for giving us your time. I have been trying to get a sleep expert on this podcast for so long because it's a huge interest of mine and obviously a huge part of everyone's daily life, in some ways better than others. And you're a neuroscientist along with being a sleep expert and have many years of experience in your field. So I feel like we're in good hands.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I love sleep. It's my absolute passion. So I appreciate any chance I get to have a discussion and just help educate people about sleep, because I think sleep really affects everybody, and having bad sleep will negatively impact almost every aspect of your life. So yeah, it's just absolutely my passion to help people.
Yeah. And when did you, well, first of all, sleep is my passion too. when did you always know you wanted to go and sleep, or how was that always something that you wanted to work in that space?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So no, I did not always know I wanted to go into sleep. I was always a pretty poor sleeper in my younger years, so in my teens and 20s, and I do have a sibling that has narcolepsy, which is a sleep disorder. But my background is actually in biomedical science, which is really just a very broad category of kind of understanding all aspects of human biology and how that relates to medicine. And I took a particular interest in neuroscience, and I ended up specializing in neuroscience for my PhD. And part of that was really researching sleep. And that's really how I gained most of my interest. And then as I went on in my career, I became super specialized in the field of sleep, in particular, how the brain controls sleep and how lack of sleep really affects the body, in particular, chronic health conditions. And so I've spent many, many years at this point doing sleep research. I've overseen clinical trials for sleep disorders. I've consulted for various sleep companies. And yeah, and now I'm a head sleep expert for a sleep tech company. So yeah, sleep. I live and breathe sleep. I'm a great sleeper now. Thankfully, I've learned a lot. But yeah, that's how I got my start.
Awesome. So that's, I've had a neuroscientist on the podcast before. We didn't focus on sleep specifically, but we definitely touched on it. So that's pretty interesting background as well. I can see how you kind of start with that and then specialize in sleep. So tell us about what actually is happening to our body, because a lot of people close their eyes at night and just, they know that they need sleep, but I don't think a lot of people actively think about what is actually happening during those precious hours throughout the night.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I actually love talking about this because it's a real eye-opener for most people. So sleep is not just putting your head on the pillow and kind of losing consciousness and resting the body. It's actually a very active and dynamic process. Your body does a lot of biological functions that it can only accomplish during those deeper stages of sleep that can't be done during the day. So some examples would be we release a ton of different hormones during sleep. In particular, a lot of our sex hormones, so things like estrogen, testosterone, also human growth hormone. So when we're not getting efficient sleep, we're missing out on a lot of those hormone releases, and this can cause hormone imbalances. We also spend a significant amount of time repairing the cells and tissues in our body that were damaged during the day. So even if you don't feel like you've done any damage to your body, you're always doing micro damage. So you're stressing out your cells, you're causing micro tears in your muscles, you're causing some damage to your bones. That all needs to be repaired. And that primarily is occurring in your slow wave sleep. So stage three of deep sleep. So, you know, when you're not sleeping, if you have an injury, you know, it takes longer for those injuries to heal or that damage can really accumulate. Another more interesting thing that was only recently discovered within about the last 5 to 10 years is our brain actually cleans itself during sleep. Right. So yeah, it's super interesting. This was one of the bigger discoveries in sleep science. So our brain uses more energy than any other part of our body. It consumes astronomical amounts of energy. And when we metabolize energy, we create a lot of waste byproducts. And these waste byproducts can build up in the brain. They can damage the neurons. Those are the cells that communicate with the rest of the body. And so this waste has to get flushed out every single night when we sleep. So during deep sleep, we have this kind of inbuilt sewer system that allows us to remove those toxic wastes. And we know that people who are, you know, always undersleeping or chronically sleep deprived are not able to efficiently remove those wastes. And that can cause issues with, you know, cognition, mental performance. And then later down the road, we also know that it may be associated with things like Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
So. Interesting. Yeah. So is it true or is it fair to say there's so many, like you talked about hormone imbalances there, and, you know, repairing our bodies. Is there so many illnesses that are tied back to sleep or can be improved with better sleep?
Absolutely. So going back to the hormone thing, so it's not abnormal for somebody who is chronically sleep deprived to have a reduced release of their sex hormones. So if you're a male, you might find that your testosterone is suddenly dipping, which has wide-ranging effects on your energy levels and your mood. And it's the same with women with estrogen and our other sex hormones as well. With the cell and tissue repair, so our cells need to be constantly repaired. When they get damaged, they're at a higher risk for cell death, or they're at a higher risk for kind of going rogue. And when they go rogue, this, of course, can cause things like cancer. So we know that sleep deprivation raises your risk significantly for many forms of cancer for this reason. It also allows the immune system to go a little bit haywire and increase inflammation in the body. And this can cause things like cardiovascular issues down the road. You know, it can raise your risk for other disorders like diabetes, increase your risk for weight gain and obesity. The list of chronic health conditions associated with poor sleep goes on and on and on. And we're always discovering more ways that sleep is affecting the body in a negative or a positive and negative way.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, we've all had those days where we just feel like we're just not ourselves. We can't go to the gym, do a proper work day, you know, hold a conversation properly, or you start getting emotional and upset. And I actually have an autoimmune disease, and I find, I mean, I didn't know the details of it, you know, scientifically, but I just always have said, my day is based on how much like sleep I've got that night before, because I could have like, you could throw anything at me, and if I've had a good night's sleep, like I'm ready to tackle it, you know. And I think that's a lot to do with energy levels, but also clear mind and being able to focus properly is just, you're just so different and so much an improved version of yourself. So that all really makes sense, and really good background there on illnesses linked to improper sleep. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the sleep cycle. So I think there's we all know a general like sleep cycle. I don't know the proper words for it, but you know, you start out in a light sleep, you have your sleep where you dream, and that's where a lot of the repair happens, I believe. And then there's like that natural cycle to wake up for work or whenever your routine alarm is set for. And I know some medications as well can affect this sleep cycle. Some specific anxiety medications can affect it, and probably others that I'm not aware of. But how important is this sleep cycle in terms of getting into a rhythm of the same sleep cycle, like waking up the same time every day, even on the weekends, not like sleeping in and trying to catch up on sleep? Can you give us a little bit of info about the sleep cycle itself?
Yeah, absolutely. So sleep is primarily controlled by two different systems that interact with each other. The first is your sleep homeostatic system, which is essentially the amount of sleep debt you build up over the day. So when I say sleep debt, what I really mean is the longer you're awake, your brain will keep tabs on that and it will calculate how much sleep you will require to make up for the hours of sleep debt that you've accumulated.
Right. Okay.
So by the end of the day, you should start feeling a lot of pressure from your brain to lay down and go to sleep. The other side of the coin is your circadian rhythm. So that's the area of your brain that runs on a 24-hour internal biological clock that tells your brain exactly when it needs to be asleep and when it needs to be awake. So humans naturally have a circadian rhythm where we're awake during the day and we're asleep at night because we're not nocturnal creatures. I mean, some people are, but most people aren't. So those two systems have to be in balance with one another. As soon as you start negatively impacting one of those systems, you'll get problems with your sleep. So if you oversleep or you take a lot of naps during the day, that can affect your ability to build up enough sleep debt. Or if, you don't keep a regular sleep schedule, so you are, going to bed at different times every single night or waking up at different times every single morning, your circadian rhythm won't stay well regulated. And so your brain won't really understand, this is the time I need to sleep. So when you do go to bed, it might be a little bit more difficult for you to fall asleep, or you might find that you're waking up more frequently at night. Mm-hmm. So the goal of good sleep is to get those two processes well aligned. And when those two processes are well aligned, we should be able to move through our four sleep stages efficiently. So we have three stages of non-rapid eye movement sleep. That's stage one, light sleep. Stage two is kind of in between light and deep. And then stage three is your slow wave deep sleep. And this is the stage where you're completely unconscious of your environment. Your body is doing a lot of that restorative work that it needs for you to feel well rested the next day. And then after stage three, we move into REM sleep. That's rapid eye movement sleep. And that's when we're really dreaming. Something I didn't bring up before is, so while we do a lot of our restorative processes during the deeper stages of sleep, we also need REM sleep for things like memory consolidation. So turning short-term memories into long-term memories, and also emotional processing. So a lot of work on the areas of your brain that control feeling and emotion and your response to stress are really worked on for REM sleep. So you really can't discount REM sleep. It is quite important as well.
Mm-hmm. And is that part where we transfer short-term memory into long-term memory? Is that where our dreams happen? And I know dreams is probably a whole different conversation in itself, but there's a lot of myths about your dreams mean things or they don't mean things or what have you. But I think there's always one type of person who has very vivid dreams, typically negative dreams or nightmares. Is that kind of where that happens in your sleep cycle?
Yeah. So that's, I'm one of those people who have really intense dreams, and I've struggled on and off with nightmares my entire life. There's a lot of theories about dreams. It's very difficult for scientists to kind of figure out why dreams happen. We have theories. So the one I really like is that when we're in REM sleep, we essentially are moving our short-term information that we've learned during the day to the long-term centers of our brains. And in order for the brain to do this, it has to kind of go through those neural connections and signaling over and over and over again until it gets stored in the proper area of our brain. But it doesn't necessarily do this in sequence with what we actually experience during the day. So that sequence of neural communication kind of gets scrambled a little bit. And that we think that may result in some of our dream activity. So dreams are not completely, you know, meaningless because you can tell, you know, if you've studied all day or if you've done a really repetitive activity, it's not unusual for you then to go ahead and have a dream about that activity.
Right.
Or if you had something really emotional happen to you, it's not abnormal to have a very emotional dream. So we know they're related. We just don't understand how. But so we think dreams are kind of an artifact of our brain just kind of replaying those neural connections needed to process short-term memories into long-term memories. We also think that REM is like a bit like having a little therapy session at night. So if you are highly stressed or you are going through a negative situation, your brain will kind of go through a semi-negative scenario, even if it's not completely related to the actual situation in your wake life. And that kind of helps the brain work through that scenario to be less responsive to it the next day, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we'll ever really figure out why dreaming occurs, but I think there's some really interesting theories about it.
Yeah, it's probably something that is obviously still developing, but just so it's so interesting from a sleep perspective, but also kind of relates back to your mental health during the day. Yeah, but I've always been a bit wary of those, you know, look into your dreams. And if you dream of butterflies, it means this and this and that. But typically, like, I'm somebody who remembers my dreams quite well. And typically, it's just stuff that I've been doing or somebody I talked to or somebody I was thinking about or something. Like, there's things happening, but there's not much really, you know, mystical meanings behind any of this.
Yeah. And I always tell people, don't necessarily look at the content of the dreams, but examine how you feel in the dreams, because that's generally more representative of what's going on in your life. So yeah, not the content, but the emotions.
Yeah, for sure. So just to go back to the sleep cycle then, what are your kind of tips in order to keep a good sleep cycle and have, you know, is it kind of go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, like avoid going to the bathroom during the night? Is there anything else that we should also think about when we're trying to get that on track?
Yeah. So number one is absolutely stick to a good sleep schedule, even on weekends and holidays. So you shouldn't be deviating more than a half an hour. That's really going to keep your circadian rhythm well-regulated. And it's also going to help you get consistent, solid sleep throughout the night. The other thing is try not to nap during the day unless you absolutely have to. And if you do nap, try to take cat naps as opposed to long naps. So try to keep your naps to about 20 to 30 minutes. This is enough time to let you cycle into stage one, light sleep, which will help you wake up feeling refreshed, but it's not going to eat into that sleep debt that you need to build up during the day. Another one that people don't really think about, because when most people think of light exposure, they automatically think, well, don't, you know, expose yourself to lights at night, like from your electronic devices or fluorescent lighting in your house. But on the other end of that spectrum, you actually do need quite a bit of light exposure in the morning during the daytime. Because that light information coming into your eyes stimulates your brain to keep your circadian rhythm in check and well-regulated. So if you do live in kind of a northern climate where you're not getting a lot of sun exposure, you could use something like a sun lamp every morning that you have on your desk while you work for a few hours. Or if you do live somewhere with good sun. You can go outside and, you know, or sit by a window and try to get some sun exposure. Of course, you know, it is important to avoid electronic screens for at least an hour before bed, because that really suppresses melatonin in your brain, and you need melatonin to tell your brain when to go to sleep.
Yeah, totally. Well, that makes sense. So I wanted to also dive into some kind of myths or some kind of fun facts about sleeping, which I'm sure you've heard before. And the first one is, why do older people seem to need less sleep than younger people?
Yeah, I hear this.
Or is it true?
I hear this all the time. So I work with people from all different ages and backgrounds, and I hear all the time that elderly individuals just need less sleep naturally. That's not true. All adults, even, you know, senior citizens, need 7 to 9 hours of good quality sleep per night. Now, the myth comes from the fact that we do go through some adjustment periods for our circadian rhythm, depending on what stage of life we're in. So generally, younger people will be going to bed later, and this will last, you know, well into our 60s. But when you get to a certain age, your circadian rhythm starts to naturally adjust backwards. So you'll be more inclined to go to bed early and wake up early. And with that comes a lot of issues with the brain, you know, naturally wanting to get up super early, but some, you know, senior citizens may be trying to stay up later than they actually should. The other issue is that the brain does go through a natural aging process, which really affects the sleep centers of our brain. So the area that controls sleep in our brain is actually quite small, and there's only about a handful of genes that control sleep. And the normal aging process can really affect the neurons and supporting cells that regulate this center. So senior citizens may find it very difficult to fall asleep. And also it's often pretty typical for them to experience sleep fragmentation or frequent nighttime awakenings. And so, you know, they assume that this is just the brain's way of telling them they don't need as much sleep, when in fact it's the brain being semi-dysfunctional. Now, there are ways we can help senior citizens get more sleep through increased sleep hygiene habits, better circadian rhythm, sleep schedules, certain medications if needed. But if you are a senior citizen and you are finding that you are sleeping consistently less than 7 hours of night, then it's really important to speak to your doctor.
Okay. I think a lot of people will agree with that, even though they're younger, like sleeping less than 7 hours, unfortunately. Not me, though. As you can tell, I'm a big fan. That makes sense. Yeah, okay. So that definitely puts things into perspective a little bit more. One thing that I've started to do, and this is like probably something that has been a tool that has been used for a long time, but it's actually listening to not white noise, but it's called brown noise. I'm not sure if there's a huge difference, but obviously typically white noise machines are more popular, especially with babies and kids. What are your thoughts on those, and how come it's so soothing?
Yeah, I think they're fantastic. So white noise and brown noise are just on different frequencies. White noise might just be random sounds, so like wind or rain or the ocean, whereas brown noise is a very set of frequencies. So it's very repeating. It's not very random. Both are great for falling asleep. And the reason for this is because in order for us to relax our brain and help our brain slow brain waves down to a point where we can drift into sleep, we have to be able to turn off our attention to outside stimulation. So this would be things like environmental stimulation, that could be noises, that could be movement, that could be touch. And some people have a very difficult time turning off their attention. Especially if you're really high stress or you're a really light sleeper. So adding white noise into that environment will mask that environmental stimulus that is causing you to find it very difficult to fall asleep. So your brain can instead focus on white noise or brown noise, which isn't as intrusive, making it easy to, you know, filter it out eventually and fall to sleep.
I used to listen to like the radio years ago, and then that turned into podcasts when they became a thing. And somebody said to me, you know, you should try like white noise if you like listening to things at night. And I tried it like a couple of weeks ago, and I was, you know, thinking this is not going to work. Like, what, you know, this is for babies. And it's just really, really soothing. And it's just made me switch over like so quickly. And to your explanation, it's actually proven, you know, it makes sense as to why it helps, but it's kind of a game changer, even though I'm not a, you know, a baby.
Yeah, I am all for white noise machines, especially if you live somewhere noisy, like a city, or mm-hmm. you have a partner that snores or sleep talks. It's fabulous. The only thing I will say is make sure you have a backup plan if you have to travel, because yeah. once you go without that white noise machine, you might really miss it. So if yeah. you can get it on a phone or something, you know, just make sure you have a plan.
Yeah, so true. Is there any other myths that, you know, things like that you have heard of or you would like to touch on and share?
One of the bigger myths, I think, in today's society is that people can exist on, you know, 4 to 5 hours of sleep per night. And it's almost celebrated in a weird sort of way, yeah. Especially in Western societies. You know, here's the worker who barely, you know, sleeps and gets all this work done. You know, he's a model employee. But that's simply not true. We have ample research showing that people who sleep less than 7 hours consistently per night are at a higher risk for so many health issues. And we kind of already touched on this earlier. Primarily, it significantly raises your risk for all sorts of cardiovascular diseases, cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, multiple mental health disorders, diabetes, injury, infectious, you know, diseases. So things like COVID or a cold. So it will catch up with you eventually, even if you're young and you feel like you can sort of bounce back from it now. You know, those health problems will compound over time, and eventually you will experience the negative effects. And we also know that sleep debt needs to be paid off. And when we get to a certain point, our brain can no longer recover. So some damage can never be undone.
Right. So did we talk about, you know, catching up on sleep? Because you referenced sleep debt there. Would that be in a form of napping, like your 20, 30 minute naps? Or how is there a way to kind of catch up? Or is it just about getting back into the right circadian rhythm and focusing on a better, stronger sleep cycle and a longer one?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can catch up on a little bit. So we know that, and this is a kind of a really debated topic in the field of sleep medicine right now, whether or not it's possible to undo any damage you've done from chronic sleep deprivation. Some scientists say no, some scientists say yes to an extent. Most scientists say you can never fully recover and you can never fully heal from the damage you've accumulated. It's possible, in my opinion, that if you know you've had a week of sleep deprivation, you can catch up to an extent. Where I think it's very unlikely that you will catch up or, you know, repair a lot of that damage is if you've been undercutting your sleep for many years, so an extended period of time. Naps are fine and they do help you catch up on some sleep debt, but ultimately it's going to be healthier for you just to get into a consistent rhythm where you're regularly getting 7 to 9 hours of good quality sleep per night. Now, that's not to say that you need to get all of your sleep done in one go. A lot of people are switching over to split sleep right now where they'll sleep for half of a night, get up for a few hours, and then go back to sleep and finish off their sleep cycle. That's fine. It's just that this chronic undercutting during the night and then trying to catch up through napping is never really going to be as healthy as just getting good quality sleep.
Yeah. All the new moms out there are probably, listening to this going like, that's me. Like I can't, you know, get enough sleep.
It's interesting that you say that though, because there have been studies that looked at sleep deprived parents specifically, because obviously new parents are going to be sleep deprived. There's really nothing you can do about that. And a lot of them are really concerned about what long-term damage they're doing. There has been research that have shown that all of the hormones and neurotransmitters we release for bonding during that early childhood time is actually neuroprotective for sleep deprivation. So it's kind of the evolution's inbuilt way to ensure that we don't do massive amounts of harm in order to have babies. So I wouldn't be too afraid, but, you know, still, if you are a parent, definitely try to sleep when you can. You know, obviously it's not a good thing to be so chronically sleep deprived that it becomes dangerous for you, but I wouldn't worry too much about the long-term effects that you're doing on your brain and body.
Yeah, I would hope so, because, you know, being a mother is obviously a natural thing. So I would hope they're protected in some way. Mm-hmm. So just to finish off, and if anybody, you know, people who are listening to this probably have gotten to the stage of the episode thinking, God, this lady must have she must have the perfect sleep routine and she must have it nailed down. Can you give us an insight into your kind of top do's and don'ts when it comes to a good night's sleep, maybe a little bit of your routine and what you recommend from, you know, in a couple of hours before bed? So like maybe no caffeine after a certain time, you know, winding down, turn off the lights, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So we've already talked about how important it is to keep a really strict sleep schedule. And we touched on, you know, not exposing yourself to too many bright lights for the first, you know, hour or two before you go to bed. But some other things that are really important would be just get into the habit of having a pre-sleep routine. So these are just things you kind of repeat every single night for about an hour or half an hour before you go to bed. And these are relaxing things, right? These are not going to be things like playing video games or watching stimulating TV shows. These are things like taking a warm bath, maybe reading a nice novel, listening to relaxation music, or meditating. A lot of people meditate too. But the point is that these things will help you relax, but by repeating them every single night, you're essentially signaling to your brain that it's time to get into sleep mode and time to get tired. Right. So we know through clinical research that people who consistently keep a routine are able to fall asleep faster and generally sleep more soundly throughout the night. Another thing is try not to bring stress into the bedroom. And really try to wind down from stress, you know, several hours before bed. And this includes things like maybe, you know, stop replying to work emails. Don't take work or arguments into the bedroom. Don't do activities that aren't relaxing in your bedroom, you know, other than sleep and romance, of course. So you want to make the nighttime about relaxing and getting yourself into a good headspace where when it is time to put your head on the pillow, your brain is already wound down enough to, you know, step down, reduce those brain signals enough to enter stage one light sleep.
Yeah.
So that's super, super important. And, you know, just if you feel like you have to do work in bed, I mean, try to limit it as much as possible. And I know that's easier than said for most people, but it's really important that your brain makes the association between your bedroom as a place to sleep and not do other activities. Another one I always tell people is it's really important to get exercise during the day. And I know everyone's heard this a million times, but exercise is super important for keeping your body not only healthy, but it also regulates your stress levels, in particular, your cortisol levels. So that's your stress hormone. A lot of people who have a lot of anxiety or stress or an overactive mind during bed have elevated cortisol levels. So exercising during the day can really reduce down those cortisol stores. Even if it's only like a brisk walk for 30 minutes, that's usually enough to help people, you know, get to bed and sleep really soundly throughout the night.
Right.
And another one I always tell people is if you do find yourself waking up or you're really having a difficult time falling asleep, do not stay in bed and toss and turn and clock watch, because that's only going to make the situation worse. You know, you're going to be tossing and turning. You're going to feel really uncomfortable. You're going to look at the clock. That's going to make you stress out about not getting enough sleep. So try to instead get up, remove yourself from the bedroom, go to a quiet area of your house where you can sit comfortably and do a relaxing activity in low light. And once you feel tired enough to get again to go back to bed, then you can go back into your bedroom and attempt to sleep again.
Yeah, that's a good tip. We tend to kind of, you know, toss and turn. It's I know I've read some things about getting up and kind of reading a book, you know, on a couch or something. I'm sure your brain wouldn't be long about saying, oh, I'm ready now, like, to go back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your brain's really good at signaling when it's time to go back to sleep. And if you do have this issue consistently where it's just taking you forever to fall asleep, or you find you're waking up frequently during the night, then talk to your doctor, because there may be an underlying sleep disorder there. It could be an insomnia, or it could be something like sleep apnea. So this is not something you want to sit on and kind of wait and see if it gets better, because, you know, the longer you're sleep deprived or having these issues, the more likely it is that you're going to go on to develop some health conditions associated with sleep loss.
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much for all this info. I hope that everyone listening has gotten something out of it. And it was really great insight. You really, well, first of all, you reinforced my hopeful good habits around sleep, but also gave me some other ideas. So really appreciate that.
Oh, fantastic. Like I said, I love talking about sleep. I love helping people. So yeah, it's been great. Thank you.